The Tom Woods Show, episode 2089.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm going to do something a little unusual today. I want to share something with you. It's an article I read not long ago, looking back at what happened in Canada with that trucker convoy and what the real long-term significance of it is. And it's a very bracing and sober assessment of the situation. It's not entirely negative, but I think it's a cautionary note about the future and if something like this were to happen again, how we might handle it, what we can expect to come of this. I thought it was very useful. And I think I'll just summarize it and share some thoughts, but I think I just want to read it to you and then maybe afterward think about the significance of it. But I just want to share this with you. This article is by Giles Hoffman, published over at AmericanMind.org, and it's called For Whom the Horns Honk. I'll link to it, of course, at tomwoods.com/2089. But as I say, I think it's something worth reading, worth hearing, worth thinking about, and worth discussing. I found out about this article from a post inside my private no-censorship group, the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is one of the benefits you get when you are kind enough to support the show over at supportinglisteners.com. I benefit from it also. This episode is evidence of that. So let me share this and then maybe talk about it a bit. So it runs as follows, and it's written by somebody who had a hand in these events or participated in them, cheered them on to some degree. So here we go. The truckers' convoy was crushed as soon as the police were unleashed. It took law enforcement only 2 days to remove every protester and vehicle from Parliament Hill. They used simple riot control techniques. Friendly and fraternizing police were replaced with tactical units who had more protective equipment and better weapons and unencumbered by body cameras and badge numbers. The suspension of usual protocols was likely planned to avoid accountability, since a future investigation would have been considered, especially due to the controversial invocation of the Emergency Act. For riot control purposes, police stand in what's called square formation, whereby officers position themselves side by side in echelons. Each echelon has a specific role. The first line was tightly formed of men who would advance after a cannon shocked frontline protesters, forcing them back. They would only advance 2 or 3 steps at a time. This first echelon held riot shields and hardwood batons and would bludgeon anyone who held ground. In the second row were officers with semi-automatic rifles and 40-millimeter multi-launchers loaded with aerosol grenades containing chemical irritants. These men stood with gaps between them so that the rear-end third line and arresting team could filter through and apprehend any targeted protester who stood confronting the front echelon as the unit forcefully advanced. It was the arresting team who were caught on video ramming gun stocks onto faces or lunging knees into ribs to pummel already submitted protesters. The crowds remained dignified while getting thrashed. Their resolution was powerful to observe and useless against an opponent with training and the instruments of force. For the naive protesters who believed that their good intentions were sufficient to stay firmly planted in Ottawa, they got a lesson in the rules of power. In the zero-sum nature of conflict, impersonal violence beats unarmed conviction. And because the demonstrators maintained their pacifism, their chance to hold the line sounded like movie dialogue. During the 2.5 weeks before our dispersal, there was a campaign of fear to dissuade new arrivals and the broadcast of threats to persuade truckers to leave. The regime made clear that their enemies were known to them. Ontario provincial police were seen handing out information leaflets to social media users who had made pro-convoy comments on Facebook as, quote, proactive contact, to signal clearly that online activity was being monitored. A list of 92,000 donors to the convoy was published, in which names, email addresses, and postal codes were circulated online and amplified through the state press. Even Twitter pages were created for identifying donors by neighborhood, and then he links to one, which he says remains active weeks after the convoy protest was dispersed. Two crowdfunding platforms were sanctioned, withholding millions of dollars under the terrorist financing rules. Canada's financial intelligence agency, FinTrack, was given new permanent powers in monitoring online donations. The personal bank accounts of organizers and donors were frozen. Some are still unable to access their funds. A class action lawsuit was filed seeking $306 million Canadian dollars in damages. The Ottawa police, with the help of a crisis management firm called Navigator Limited, began issuing menacing statements over their Twitter page, citing their ability to use cell phone location services, drone surveillance, and facial recognition software to identify protesters for, quote, months to come, unquote, with the guarantee of criminal and financial charges. Parents were warned about the imminent removal of their children by child protection services. The police apprehended supporters caught furnishing supplies. Several organizers were arrested, some released without charge, while others continued to be detained for petty infractions. Every scare tactic failed. Most backfired. It is unlikely that Canadian financial institutions will recover anytime soon, reputationally anyway, because the debanking of political activists is a new market risk that had previously never existed. The revolt was largely staged in opposition to the regime's use of the pandemic as a pretext for rescinding civil liberties. When the government responded by restricting more autonomy, angry Canadians only became further emboldened. As I noted previously, the regime faced three choices: negotiate, do nothing while hand-wringing, or forcibly remove the truckers. Our elected representatives never entered good faith conversations. They stalled and head scratched for almost 3 weeks, using that time to establish a political narrative upon which legal justification could be assumed. The regime's supporters grew fervid as the convoy continued, while detractors exposed the government's sanctimony and duplicity towards democratic protest. But the convoy and its supporters never intended to fight, and many left when the tactical units were bussed in. Those who remained defiant were admirable in mind, but only became the police force's punching bag. Such physical brutality is viscerally appalling, but pales in effect compared to what will come: the dragging of demonstrators into legal quagmires. The relentless pursuit by prosecuting lawyers over years will make the process the punishment. The streets of Canada's capital are now clear, but the hostility between the regime and its people is growing rapidly, metastasizing, and will soon manifest into other conflicts. The next time Canadians challenge the state, however, they cannot do so as part of a disorganized grassroots movement. They will have to use the lessons learned from this confrontation to prepare for the next. The organization came together and established three distinct command centers for the purposes of procurement, security, and media. These headquarters were based within three separate hotels in downtown Ottawa. During the first week, it was hard to put together an effective hierarchy while the occupation was in full force. Like changing wheels on a moving car, we could never pause and remove ourselves from the exigencies of the protest. Because there were hundreds of trucks, the logistics for supplies were a priority. It was simple: no trucks, no convoy. Efficient communication channels had to be established for suppliers not to be overwhelmed with requests. The streets of Ottawa run north-south and east-west, forming a regular grid pattern over which the long-haul trucks were parked head-to-tail within all but one lane so that emergency vehicles could pass. The geography was then partitioned and block captains appointed from each section. The block captains gathered requests from the truckers within their areas and then relayed their needs to our headquarters. The needs were then put in categories such as fuel, food, laundry, etc., for which one specific person was responsible. To no surprise, fuel was in the greatest demand. It was needed to keep the trucks running, and not only for the horns that require air compression, but more importantly for the heat that kept sleeping truckers warm while temperatures fell to extremes as cold as minus 13 Fahrenheit. Our procurement strategy was targeted because it was essential, and bypassing obstacles became a continuous game between regime and convoy. First, large fuel tankers were denied entry into downtown Ottawa. So we used pickup trucks with slip tanks, which are in-bed auxiliary containers. We then had to fill jerry cans in nearby parking lots and wheelbarrow them in. Eventually, the police started arresting anyone carrying a jerry can with fuel. In response, hundreds of protesters bought out entire stores of their fueling containers and carried empty ones, for which they could not be arrested. One notably amusing protester had filled his fuel jug with water, and whenever law enforcement surrounded him, he would start drinking from the yellow spout. He would then shout incomprehensible Quebecois French at the police as they trudged away, having been fooled. The Security Command Center was much better organized than the procurement and media war rooms. The security team was made of serious men with decades-long experience in policing, military, and intelligence. We had many active law enforcement officers within our ranks, including Ottawa police, veterans of the Afghanistan War, one sniper from the Prime Minister's private security detail, and a CSIS counterterrorism expert. This was the only command center in which there was a clear order of battle. The security operations could furthermore divide into two separate categories, on-the-ground safety and communications with police. The stage, where speakers would pontificate and musicians would perform, had to be secure. Suspicious characters and agent provocateurs were constantly monitored for, and at night, we had entire units survey for conflict or danger. Every morning, we had meetings in which new developments were discussed and daily updates were registered. Maps and charts with tactical information, such as the number and location of trucks and where the police were located, were shared by ex-military with reconnaissance experience. The second prong of security was dealing directly with the regime. Only two or three members would participate in those secret meetings. These people still had access to information from the inside, and they would receive intel about the regime's plans. Through these channels, we were also fed genuine disinformation that frequently caused paranoia within our ranks. For instance, on the night of February 16th, the same day 2,000 firearms were reportedly stolen nearby, we were informed through trusted police sources about planted weapons, some 400 guns, which the police would discover and use to arrest us. Such rumors had to be addressed even when dubious, since preempting a fiction was preferable to having to do damage control. The media team was both the megaphone for the convoy and their only shared weapon. Every conflict now is largely an information war and a public relations battle. The regime has a well-oiled propaganda machine, and they curated footage with spurious themes. For the regime, it was insufficient to have opponents. They needed enemies, which is why so much effort was expended to portray the demonstrators as dangerous ultranationalists and racists. They employed the stale villains of the 20th century, and the media team spent most of its time disabusing those lies put out by the regime, its enablers, and their media sycophants. We were successful insofar as the truth was obvious for those who cared to look. The Freedom Convoy had to play the inverse game of the corporate press, demonstrators good, regime bad, using hundreds of hours of raw footage made available by citizen journalists. Since the truth was on our side, this was easy to do, and we succeeded in a waking up of many normal Canadians who would have otherwise believed the fabrications of the mendacious media. It is possible, though, that revealing the peaceful intentions of the protesters made our movement easier to finish off. We had expunged anyone who had ostentatiously called for violence, fed, posted, or planted false flags. Such cleansing efforts may have gained us sympathy from a minority of fence-straddling Canadians, but their support ultimately amounts to very little. The past 2 years have made clear that passive citizens can be browbeaten and intimidated into compliance. Conversely, having unpolished yokels live-streaming their manic enthusiasm might have kept the police second-guessing. Peaceful protesters are predictable and less risky to confront, but the media team would have found it difficult to adopt a PR strategy centered on the rowdiest elements of the protest, not least because they had more conventional white-collar resumes than anyone else in the convoy. Everyone in the media team had a university education, and most had worked in politics or government relations. These were people who had come from within the system. This put them under a suspicious light. However, they were also the only people who knew how to play the game. They knew how to write provocative speeches and press releases while limiting legal repercussions. What the Freedom Convoy achieved within its pre-established constrained parameters will become clearer in time. We did not end the mandates nor the vaccine passports, our ostensible goals, though most restrictions were lifted, resulting from our pressure. The Conservative Party of Canada removed its feckless leader, and our contentious presence became a domino flick that resulted in a cascade of resignations within the Ottawa police and elsewhere in the permanent bureaucracy. The resignations may have felt like victories, but were actually defeats, since the vacated positions are now being replaced with regime loyalists. Protests work well when they align with the aims of the regime, at which point any violence and lawlessness will be excused, as with the Black Lives Matter riots of 2020. When demonstrations contradict the regime's agenda, they only serve as a brief pressure release for discontentment, after which you are expected to go home. But reductive analysis maps poorly onto the current fight. The convoy is best understood by allusions to the instincts and the spirit of a people. It's not even what the protesters say that matters. This is why pundits rarely understand populism. Even if the Freedom Convoy lost this fight, they have made the battle lines clearer, and more people are understanding politics as a matter of distinguishing friends and foes. It's becoming less about thoughts and more about feelings. Very few dissidents are in consensus over anything. The West is fracturing anew, and everyone has their own ideas, ideals, and concepts to describe a good future. Most have gone down their unique rabbit hole. But what they share is the feeling of oppression by tyranny. This is especially true for the working class, who are the first to experience the material consequences of a failing country. Indeed, most demonstrators did not necessarily know what they stood for in positive terms, but they knew what they were fighting against. The demonstration may have failed its putative goals and only strengthened the establishment, but it also stripped off the cosmetics of democratic decorum that mask the Canadian oligarchy, exposing it as a marionette to globalized and corporate interests. The convoy made the deep state exoteric. From my perspective within the Freedom Convoy, we both succeeded and failed. The significance of this truckers' demonstration will only be determined by those who can claim a future victory. Some mistakes were merely operational. There was no vetting. I gave one person my pseudonym and an invented autobiography, and within hours, I was in a boardroom with all the organizers going through maps, talking about internal weak points, looking at charts, and inputting every important phone number into my contact list. The lack of operational security was astounding. The grassroots organization also meant that no one, yet everyone, was in charge. It was a classic case of too many chiefs, not enough Indians, but worse, as if the chiefs had all been drinking mouthwash. So much time was wasted between defective people competing for status and control, including podcasters and lawyers who thought of themselves as serious leaders, that it felt like the Special Olympics of political resistance. Resultantly, there was no distinction between strategy and tactics. Some organizers became so committed to certain small tasks, they could not understand that a bigger picture existed, while at the same time, it was rare for anyone to discuss what success would look like. Another problem was the lack of quality men. We had some who were brave and others who were sharp, but few who were both. Most damaging of all was that nearly every organizer saw the occupation and their battle with the regime through the lens of a feminine morality, with undue concern about how we would be perceived. There was no understanding of conflict. The organizers couldn't even fathom the regime extending its power through the judiciary or the financial system. And every time the government used the tools within their control, the organizers would become histrionic and take comfort in videos of commentary and ranting by political celebrities who supported the convoy. Somehow, most organizers and demonstrators held two incompatible premises at the same time. They took for granted that the Canadian government had been acting illegally over the past 2 years, even harming its citizenry for their own gain, and also believed guilelessly that the government would not lie, seize donations, freeze personal finances, use brutal force, or commit any other illegal action regarding the convoy. Every time the government demonstrated its willingness not to play fair, there was widespread emotional breakdown among the organizers. Some left fearful for their lives, while others became meritoriously cavalier and tried to get themselves arrested, even if their skill set was irreplaceable. There was an indulgent narcissism in the desire to be arrested for counseling to commit mischief, and other misdemeanors. Since most organizers were released without charge, there was a sense that you could achieve martyrdom without real sacrifice. The Freedom Convoy acted as a beacon for the regime's opponents. Many people who were closeted dissidents are now actually organizing. Some people will try to subvert the system technically from within. The importance of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is no longer theoretical, and people who want to extricate themselves from the centralized and captured banks have an opportunity to move their earnings from fiat currency into self-custodial ones. Others will probably buy just precious metals or pull cash from the banks. Both work when it comes to undermining the current structure. For others, living under the thumb of the regime is no longer an option. There is already an exodus from larger Canadian cities. We will likely see rural communities establish themselves separately, like the Mennonites or the Haredim. The dizzying rate of technological advancement and ever-increasing government control seems to provoke a widespread desire to live like traditional peasantry, where at least people have authority over their food and their bodies. And at the rate of inflation, the only meat you may soon afford to eat is what you rear as livestock. In the meantime, the Canadian regime will continue eroding liberties. Guns, privacy, money, anything that can be controlled will be controlled, and the shift of power will always migrate toward the lever pullers at the center. This may seem fine, people choosing how they want to live and segregating themselves. But the regime will never allow a segment of society which has chewed off its own leg to thrive in freedom. It would threaten their authority. A nation cannot survive internal fracturing. Therefore, it is difficult to envision a future without either complete submission to the state or violent confrontations between dissidents and the government. It will largely depend on the spiritedness of the people and what they are willing to sacrifice to live freely. Hey everybody, let's take just a minute to remind you that there are so many things that people can struggle with, like anxiety and depression and stress and relationship issues, and they afflict us for so long and so regularly that we come to assume that this is just part of life, that there's nothing we can do about this. This is just our fate. In fact, we're so caught in it that the very question of whether it could be avoided, whether there's anything that could be done about it, sometimes doesn't even cross our minds. Well, Woods is here to tell you that there is help in the form of our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will figure out exactly what it is you need, match you up with a licensed professional therapist who specializes in what you need. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can check out the ton of testimonials on their website. And by the way, just in case they don't fix you up with your perfect therapeutic match, they'll get you another one. So many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. All right, so that is it. That's the article. And it's pretty grim in some places. You can see what the implication of it is, that if people are going to be serious, they're going to have to consider, let's say, bolder sorts of strategies. But the problem with that is that I don't think you can beat the state at its own game, that the state specializes in violence. You can't beat the state at its own game. See, when you look at what happened with the regimes in Eastern Europe in 1989, that was a matter of the public had just had it. And in this case, it wasn't like an angry 10% of the public. It was a huge number of people, such that you had massive, massive public demonstrations against these regimes. And they collapsed. They collapsed because they did not have the consent of the public anymore. The problem we have in the West is all too much consent, is that most people are prepared to just accept what they're told. And if that means that dissident voices who are sacrificing everything for their principles are in fact evil white nationalists and racists, then that's what they'll believe. And so that is a major, major problem that we're dealing with. And then at the end, the last paragraph that talks about, well, what if some people just kind of separate off from society and break away and do their own thing? The thing is, the regime won't leave them alone, he says. But I think he says it for the wrong reason. I think it's because there is an ideology, not just in the United States, but throughout the West, that is universalist in the sense that there has to be one rule for everybody and we all need to have the same values, even if they have to be drummed into your head. And we need to extend our ideas of what's best for human beings to everybody. And so we can't just have some people live one way and some live another. we have to go around crusading until we get a world that's entirely in our image. When you have that kind of mentality, how can you leave people alone? I have a little bit more optimism about this, though, at least in the United States. We've seen through 2020 that federalism is actually alive and well, and that you can find states where some form of sanity will nevertheless prevail. And then within those states, you can find counties, towns that will more or less leave you alone or that won't demand your conformity to whatever the latest fad is. As for what we should do next, I can understand people who hold either of two views. One is that we have to just continue our work of educating the public and trying to bring as many people over to our side as possible. I get that. I do that. You see me doing that all the time. But wow, do we have a public that is compliant. We really do have a 50-50 situation. At least, again, I'm speaking about the United States because that's what I know best, even though the article's about Canada. The article's implications obviously extend well beyond Canada. But in the United States, I think it's like 50-50. But it swings back and forth. But the 150 also, you know, one side has all the major influential voices because they're all either lizard people or cowards and they don't want to express forbidden opinions. So they just jump on board whatever they're told to do. And so that's why Hollywood actors all have the same opinion on everything because they're all cowards and very, very few of them have what it takes to be genuine dissidents. So you get one side of this 50-50 divide having all those voices and the others having very, very few public voices and yet still having extraordinary resilience and independence of thought. I mean, it's amazing to me how after all the demonization of them, there are still half of Americans who just don't go along with the major narrative on major things. That's very, very significant. But to get much beyond that 50-50 seems like such a tough nut to crack. Because as I say, there are so many who just want to jump on whatever they're told to believe. There is a chunk of independent voters who might be somewhat reachable, who understand that what was done to children over the past 2 years has been very bad, and they are turned off by some of the more extreme policies of the Democrats. But I've always been disappointed in people who call themselves, quote, independents, you know, because you think independent, well, that means they must have really creative and interesting ideas. And it really doesn't mean that. It means they have some ideas from one of the two major political parties and some ideas from the other one. And they just have this mishmash, and that's who they are as independents. You would think an independent would be somebody who disagrees with both sides on war and disagrees with both sides about money and whatever. I mean, there'd be a real independent. But most people who are independent, this is just a side bit of frustration on my part. Most people call themselves independents are not independent at all. Yeah, they also want the Fed. Yeah, they also are more or less okay with the military-industrial complex. Yeah, they basically also are okay with more or less the current tax structure, except we'll just make a few trivial changes along the edges. So it's not really that independent. You know, the people who call themselves independents, it just means I haven't really thought things through. So I'm much more interested in seeing if there are real independents out there we can appeal to. But even so, even the conventional, quote, independents, who are really just a confused amalgam of the two major parties, at least some of them, by virtue of not belonging to one of the parties, not belonging to the Democrats, they're not necessarily convinced that an all-out war against half the country is really the right way forward. And they're not convinced that everything the Democrats have in store for them is the best idea. And that's at least something to build on. But the other side, so one side is going to say, we got to just keep going, educate people as much as possible, keep our work going. The other side says, you got to just look out for yourself at this point. You got to look out for yourself, your family, people you care about, your local area, whatever is immediately significant to you, and give up this hopeless plan of getting 80 million people to vote for a president you like. You got to just give that up. That's not happening. You have to be where you are and build what you can where you are. And I can totally understand that point of view as well. I feel like for me, the best solution is doing both simultaneously. I mean, like, it's not like because I'm doing the Tom Woods show, I can't also focus on my family. I think I'm able to do both things. And in fact, you know, my family's usually busy with other things while I'm recording the Tom Woods show. So it's no real problem. So I'd like to do both of these, but I totally understand people who focus on one rather than the other. Now, the author of this article complains about the way the convoy effort was run. He complains about it in certain spots here, and basically that it was kind of a not super professional. But what actually stood out to me in the article was how organized and what an amazing operation it was. I mean, that was really what came through to me. I mean, yeah, of course, a bunch of people who don't do political organization for a living are going to make some mistakes. Yeah, I mean, that's actually not a particularly interesting conclusion to draw. What's fascinating is learning all the different layers of organization that went into this thing. I mean, I'm sure listening to this, you were, or at least I assume you were struck by that also. That to me, that's the story, that all these regular people somehow put together this extraordinary command center. And yeah, it was their first time doing it. And yeah, some of them were naive and some of them still in their heart of hearts had internalized what they'd been taught in school about how benign the people who rule over them were. And it was hard for them to get over some of these things. Yeah, I get that. But they've never done anything like this before. And no doubt they will learn lessons for the future. But again, it's hard to know exactly what are the lessons to learn here. What are the lessons to learn? Because it is possible that some of these people, even though not arrested, could wind up being ruined in other ways if the Canadian legal system just hounds them and hounds them and hounds them. And so what do you do next time, knowing that the regime could well pull out all the stops and throw at you every resource the authorities have to hurt you for a long time? So what is the right approach? And you know, I'm going to be honest enough to tell you, I don't know. I'm not very good with things like this. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts. Okay, so if there needs to be this level of protest in the future, what does it look like? Does it look like this kind of direct confrontation? Does it look like behind the scenes, we just start getting more into crypto, but the right kind of crypto, so that we and no other institution has control of our medium of exchange, or some other approach? I'd be curious to hear what you think. So of course, the show notes page allows for comments. The show notes page is tomwoods.com/2089. And I'd like to hear what you think after hearing this. What should the next one of these look like if it should come to that? What lessons should we draw? What should we do differently? Should we do this kind of thing at all? And yet I feel like even if it didn't turn out exactly the way they wanted, it did have these indirect effects of knocking down some of these restrictions. I think that was caused by the convoy. And I do think, as I noted with a reporter from Rebel News, that the state of public opinion in Canada shifted dramatically because of the convoy, because suddenly now it seemed acceptable to say that you favored what they favored, because you could see how many people supported this. And that's really good. That's not going to be much consolation, though, to those people whose lives will be ruined if the Canadian government really pursues them. So I really, really would like to hear from those of you who listen what you think about this. What are your insights about this? So tomwoods.com/2089. And as I mentioned in the previous episode, for those of you who really do think that I just want to unplug and go out to the country and build something there, again, I want to urge you to check out the program that John Bush is putting on. He's got an event in person in Texas, but you can also attend it virtually if you don't feel like traveling to Texas. And if you attend virtually, you can actually attend the first couple of days of it completely free. So check it out at tomwoods.com/exit, because that's what John is all about, exit and build. So if that has some appeal to you, you should check out John's event. Because as I say, you can attend the first couple of days for free virtually if you like. And some of the speakers will be people you've heard of. If you're interested in any of this stuff, you will know their names. And I'm sure you'll find this valuable. John always does good stuff. You know him from the Tom Woods Show. And if you've been around the Ron Paul movement for a while, from 2007 onward, John was at everything. You kept running into John. You would say, who is this 12-year-old guy? He has this extremely youthful face. Don't let that fool you. He has the wisdom of an older man, and he's older than he looks. He has to be. So anyway, tomwoods.com/exit is worth checking out for that reason. And tomorrow, I'm going to have Jason Rink on the program, the most canceled filmmaker in America. So tune in for that. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.